My name's Paul Collins. I'm talking to Dr. Ralph Healy about his memories of working at the Harrison Pearson Building. Before we start talking, Ralph, can I ask you whether you're happy for me to record this?
Of course.
Thank you very much. Okay, can you tell me when you worked in the Harrison Pearson Building?
I didn't actually work in the Harrison Pearson Building. Mm-hmm. I worked for EJ&J Pearson, and Harrison Pearson were part of
that
EJ&J
group.
Pearson group. Yeah. But I visited Harrison Pearson almost daily in the course of picking up materials for testing and discussing products and where they were to be used.
Ah. So what range of years are we talking about?
I came down to working in Stourbridge in 1952, mm-hmm. and I worked for EJ&J Pearson, and in between J.T. Price joined with us, so we were Price Pearson, for 19 years.
19 years, starting when, do you remember?
1952 was when I...
So you're 18 years, so you're there till 1968?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So... you say that you didn't actually work in the buildings. You didn't work in that little office.
Not in the building, no.
Do you work in that little office on the other side or not?
I was frequently in the office on the other side.
Right.
Because I came originally to Stourbridge to carry out research work on products for the glass industry.
Oh, right. So you were interested in sort of glass pot side of things?
Well, yes, glass pots, but more in what we call glass tank blocks, which are the very large blocks
that
are used for building furnaces for making bottles and flat glass and the like.
I'm with
Although
you.
I was involved in pot making mm-hmm. too, because we, shortly after I joined them, we, EJ&J Pearson, shared a pot building set up with Stewart's Glassworks.
Oh, right.
And I helped them to set up that mm-hmm. pot works. Mm-hmm. Formerly, most of the glass manufacturers had pot rooms on the side, just making just a few pots, and others bought pots chiefly from some of the refractors works around Stourbridge, mm-hmm. but principally at that time from a company called Parkinson and Spencer, who worked fire clays in Yorkshire.
Right, okay. So they didn't source them locally, they sourced them from Yorkshire, basically.
They sourced them from Yorkshire. Yeah. And sometimes they took clay from Yorkshire too. Most of the glass manufacturers had a small pot room, but Stewart's were not satisfied with the pots that were made in Yorkshire or the pots made from Yorkshire clay, so they decided that they would go further afield and we imported clay from Germany.
Goodness.
Gross Almeroda clay, which is a very fine clay, made wonderful pots. And we set up this pot room at Colleygate, really.
Yeah.
It was.
So what aspect of your work for EJ&J Pearson actually took you into the...
No sooner had I got to EJ&J Pearson and I'd begun training people in research into the glass contact materials, I got involved in all the other sort of products that they made. I became something of an expert on night storage heater refractories.
Oh, yes.
Strangely enough.
Because that's something that's a manufacturer, they diversified into making those bricks that went around the elements in the night storage heaters, didn't they?
Yes.
That's right.
But I saw the whole of the night storage heater business move from fire clay through to the more dense terracotta clay, red brick clay, in effect. And then to clay, where we added chromo, which we brought over from South Africa. And then further, we started to bring over materials like olivine from Norway and Sweden. And then finally, we brought iron ore from Sweden and other places and just mixed that with a small amount of clay and pressed the sort of night storage blocks that you see today.
Yes, because they're sort of big bricks, over-large bricks with a semicircular groove in them which went round the element, aren't they?
Yes, basically. Initially within the Pearson group, and we made them at the Delf, which was...
Is that the cricket fields?
No, the Delf works is the one below Briley Hill, down by the canal side, right on the edge of the village of Withymore.
I know what you mean,
Pearsons were the first people into that business. We made them for GC, who had a design involving the production of a large slab of clay about, 2 foot 6 long, 9 inches wide, 3 inches thick, with a spiral groove running around it.
Right.
And these were sent away to GC in one of their factories, where armies of girls chucked them in lathes and wound a nickel chrome wire around the element.
Right.
And then outside
those... So
that
was a core, basically.
Sorry?
It was a core you were making.
That was the core.
Yeah, right.
And round that was stacked a pair of U-shaped blocks around the outside.
Yeah, got it.
Later, the design changed and they were just pressed rectangular blocks with a groove in them. And they were sent out to site then in little cardboard boxes and they were assembled on site because the whole thing weighed a lot. But we went into the development of materials that give the same heat storage capacity in smaller units as were in the original units, were like small pianos and huge things when they... GC first started to make them. They were used only in shop and factory premises.
Oh, right.
And then when the cheaper overnight electricity was allowed,
it was economy
the
seven
whole
stuff.
Thing blossomed. The units became smaller and they were introduced into
domestic premises,
and they had to be much smaller. Yeah. And of course, ultimately, with iron oxide... and the super insulation, they could be made not much larger than an ordinary cast iron radiator.
I think those we had some at home on Economy 7, it was called in those days.
Yes,
and they were about this, we've got a radiator bias here, they're about this sort of size, and they came out like that and stood on the floor. But they were,
so I was involved in that.
They were
almost inordinately for 20 years.
Heavy things, though,
weren't
they?
Oh, they were,
all those
They had to. The heat storage capacity was a product of the specific heat of the minerals that we use.
Yes.
That's where the iron ore came in and the olivine and so on. And the mass, the weight, product of the two things gave us the heat storage capacity.
Yes. One of the things that I'm really interested to talk to you about is you knew Harrison Pearson sort of in its latter years. You said you had... course to visit there between 52 and 68.
Yes.
And the side of it, in every sense, that you visited, it is the bit we know least about, and that's the two little offices on the right-hand side of the arch as you go in.
Yes.
And it's been called by various people who've interviewed, they've called it the specials department, or the casting department, or the silicates department, it was called by
well...
if you could just tell us a little bit about what went on inside there.
Yeah. Inside there... soon after the war, E.J.J. Pearson, who'd manufactured glasshouse pots and these large tank blocks, some weighing half a ton each, in fire clay, chiefly at Homer Hill Works, Samuel Evers Works, chiefly there, they decided that they had to compete with some blocks which were being used, which were manufactured by electrically fusing minerals.
Right.
And they started to make them using a mineral which we brought over from the foothills of the Himalayas.
Goodness me.
A material called silimanite.
Mm-hmm.
That's sometimes that department you're speaking of was called the Suleimanite department.
Yes.
But the Suleimanite came from the Himalayas, and it was brought over, shipped into the factory that was concerned with those two small officers, where it was fired in kilns to very high temperature, which caused it to crack and break up, because as mined, well, no, it wasn't mined, it was just dug off a hillside, it was very, very strong and very difficult to crush. So we heated it, and this caused it to change its crystalline form and made it easier to crush. And this was then mixed with clay. In our case, it was China clay from Cornwall, and ball clay from Devon. And there's a system whereby if we added a small amount of alkali, in our case it was sodium silicate, water glass, and soda ash, a small amount of this, 0.5% in total, one could make a fluid mixture at water contents, which were quite low. Normally, you need maybe 15-20% water to make clay, even soft plastic. But to make it flow as a slip, you use these alkalis, and this is what we developed there in that corner of the works.
Oh, right. So when some people call it the casting department,
that's
that,
right.
That would be because you're using a slip.
We used a slip,
into moulds like that.
And in order to get into that, E.J. and J. Pearson brought down to Stourbridge from Yorkshire a man who had been experienced in slip casting clayware. His name was Sidney Waterton, Dr. Waterton.
I've heard that name mentioned before, yes.
And he came down and he introduced that in that corner of the works. It was a corner of what had been Harrison Pearson's works. It was a spare stove. And
so this was done at what at the back of the offices was this done? Or
right down in the far corner.
Oh, the far back corner of the actual office,
right in the far corner, yes.
Right, okay.
Diagonally opposite where the offices were, the office, the roadside office block. Yes. It was way in the far corner.
So the roadside office was Dr. Waterton's office, basically. And who did he, what did he work on his own? Did he have a secretary? Or
He had, there was a small, what you might call a kitchen.
That was the first, as you go into that, that's the first room you come to at the back.
It's the one on the back.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really was nothing more than a kitchen where they made tea.
Had a kind of range in it as well, somebody told me. Yes.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Okay. But the office on the roadside was where Sidney Waterton sat, and his secretary sat in his office with him.
Oh, right.
And that was all the offices that he had on the roadside. Down on the works, there was a wooden hut, which was the foreman's office, who controlled the manufacture of the slip casting stuff. And it was a unique process that we could cause this. We mixed these materials together in a large, what we called a blunger, which is a big hexagonal tank with big paddles inside.
Yes.
And this was swished round almost for 24 hours, and it was in a fluid condition. And just immediately prior to casting, we had a large tank, which we evacuated with a pump. And then we opened a valve, and this slurry was sucked over from the mixing arc into this tank.
Yeah.
And in doing so, it removed all the bubbles that had been stirred into the thing.
Oh, of course, yes. Because that, I mean, the kind of things that you were making there. Somebody told me heating elements for gas fires and various other things.
That was at a later stage,
yes.
Yeah,
but I mean, the sort
tell
of
you about that.
Precision stuff that you were doing, I presume it was precision.
The tank blocks.
The last thing you want is trapped air or bubbles
That's right.
or anything like that.
That's right. And The slurry was then cast into large moulds which were made of plaster of Paris.
Right.
But the slip was so balanced that it was what we call thixotropic. Mm. It was fluid as long as you stirred it. Immediately stopped stirring it.
Yes.
It became
solid.
Solid.
Yes. Like those paints used to be years ago.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly so. Yeah. Same principle.
Yeah.
And the plaster of Paris mould was not so much to dewater the thing and mm-hmm. set it. It calcium sulfate, plaster of Paris, had a neutralising effect on the deflocculants that we used to cause the thing to be fluid.
Oh, right, okay.
So it just developed a skin on the surface, no
right.
more. It wasn't the dewatering process.
No.
It was just simply that the thixotropy caused the thing to set as soon as we stopped stirring.
So did that make for a more precise casting, and did it mean that...
Well, it meant that the mould could be stripped off pretty quickly,
yes.
within 24 hours, because
right.
the thing had become sufficiently rigid,
yes.
that you could strip the mould off.
Right.
You couldn't,
and it didn't
hand...
deform after you took it out of the mould?
No, it didn't.
No.
No. And the slip was so... Unlike slips used in the potteries to make jugs and mm. things like that, where they pour a very fluid slip mm. into plaster of Paris, mm. it builds up a layer
mm.
On the plaster of Paris, and then they turn the fluid remaining stuff out of the centre, and it's
right.
left with...
Yes.
Just, well, our slip casting was such that... the whole of the mass became solid,
right.
and it contained as much as 80% of non-plastic clay materials, this mm. sillimanite that mm. we brought from
mm.
India.
Mm.
And then it was left in a warm room
mm-hmm.
where it gradually dried out.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that stage they could be upended mm-hmm. and... Sometimes, if they were cast a bit oversized, the top could be scraped off to bring them roughly to size. Mm. And these, when they were dry, were manhandled
mm-hmm.
quite skillfully into mm-hmm. the kilns that had been designed to fire to at least 1400 centigrade and even higher than that.
Gosh, that's almost steel melting temperature.
It is indeed,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah.
And they were... fired in there, stacked up, and because they started off with raw materials that had already been shrunk and pre-fired,
so
as
there
it
wasn't
were,
any shrinkage.
There was very little
very
shrinkage.
Very little shrinkage, yeah.
And they were brought out of there, but because the glass industry wanted to fit these blocks together with a very high degree of precision.
Mm-hmm.
We actually ground the surfaces. We only took off something like a quarter of an inch.
Mm-hmm.
They'd hardly shrunk, but the surface were perhaps a little bit irregular.
Mm.
So we put them into a large grinding machine, the sort of thing that was used for grinding granite tombstones and the like.
Oh, right. So also
and
like
we
a, more
skimmed
like a,
off the surface.
More like a polisher than anything else.
Yes, it was taking off perhaps an eighth to a quarter of an inch
yes.
off a pair of parallel faces, because
right.
these things were mounted on a sort of a trolley which was wound between the spinning grinding
right.
wheels.
Right.
So we ground a pair
ground
of parallel
together.
Surfaces.
Together.
Yeah.
Right. So they'd be a perfect fit.
Yeah.
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 So then
we didn't grind the... The face that was went to face the glass or the outside of the furnace, but the matching faces where one block had to fit to another,
right.
they were ground to a high degree of precision.
So when they were fitted together, were they just fitted together? There wasn't anything binding them together. It was
there
just
was
the,
no jointing.
It was
material.
Just the just
there was a,
the
just
tightness
a tight
of the fit,
fit.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
yeah,
yeah,
and it was
yeah.
so tight that none of the glass could get in between. And
that's right.
Right, that's a general
well,
idea.
Well, what happened is the glass was molten on the inside,
yeah.
and as it any that got into the joints were always the most vulnerable
yes.
part, but any that got into the joint froze.
Right.
And the outside of the large tank furnaces that were used for melting bottle glass in or window sheet glass, which contained anything from 300 to 1,000 tons of molten glass.
Mm.
There were usually air-cooled around the outside, particularly at the surface level of the glass.
Yes. Mm. Going back to the Harrison Pearson building, which was you know the focus of our work, was Dr. Waterton there all the time that you were there visiting, or was he succeeded by somebody?
No, he for a period of time he was made a director of EJ&J Pearson.
Right.
But then it was not a very comfortable relationship. Mm-hmm. He wasn't the easiest of men to get on with.
Right, okay.
And he had very strong opinions about various things, and he was a communist.
Right.
And he felt that industry, being run by family companies, wasn't quite the way to put the world to rights.
Oh, right, I understand.
And he made his views known.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, he was a good technical man
and
a good businessman.
Yeah.
And he virtually ran the work from there, and he, end of the day sort of thing.
Yes.
We had one salesman out in the field visiting the glassworks.
Yeah.
And he reported virtually back to Waterton.
Yeah. So how long did he stay there after you say he came in to set the thing up and he ran it for a while, but how long?
Yes, he'd been there from, I think, just after the war.
Right, okay.
And he was there during my time for about 15 years, I think.
Okay, so
then he up and left, and in fact went to Canada.
Oh, right, okay. So, in fact, if you say 52, 15 years would be 67, so that's not really not much before you went yourself.
No.
No.
No, I went a few years after that.
Right, yeah. Okay. Can you remember who followed him there, or did they not
replace
him?
Yes, yes. I had taken a young fellow from school with a school certificate, and he'd worked in my laboratory for a number of years as a chemist at the bench, doing chemical analysis, and then doing other things, testing of refractory materials from around the group. But I use my test laboratory to train a lot of people who ultimately went out into the works as departmental managers, foremen, and the like. And Arthur Timmins was the name of the guy.
This name has come up as
he
well.
He went out there,
right,
and he worked along with Sidney Waterton. And eventually took over the managership.
Right.
In the meantime, Sidney Waterton had been made a director, and he moved his office from there for a year or two over to Homer Hill Works, Samuel Evers Works, that also made tank blocks, but they made them by pneumatically ramming ordinary, the local fire clays.
So Arthur Timmins took over Waterson's office.
He took over the running of the works as a kind of a foreman to begin with.
Yeah.
And then when Waterton moved his office, as he became a director, to be direct in charge of both the casting department and Homer Hill Works.
Yeah.
But he travelled between the two works daily.
Right.
And Arthur Timmins moved permanently into the office by the roadside.
I'm with you. Yeah. I'm with you. And Arthur Timmins was still there until you lost your connection.
Oh, yes, he was. Yeah. And for a year
a while,
or two
a while
after,
yes.
Afterwards.
Yes, his name's cropped up in several of the interviews that I've done.
And then, because we were involved in all sorts of materials used in the glass industry, we developed a technique of casting small special items that were used in the glass industry, the sort of orifice rings through which the glass finally emerged right. from the tank furnace
right.
and the rods which control the flow,
yep.
Those sort of things.
Yep.
And we took a license from a company in London who developed a process of casting materials which were substantially China clay aggregates
mm-hmm.
using a process where a bond somewhat similar to a silicone was being used. Mm-hmm. And we, when we first took over this license, we opened a very small department, again in the far corner of the works,
right.
next to the casting works.
Mm-hmm.
And that was run by Ray Barrett. Again, he was...
That name's come up as
yeah,
well.
Ray Barrett
yeah.
was one of my
lads. One of your
lads.
Trainees, really.
Yeah, he yeah. came out straight from Stourbridge Grammar School to work for me. And then he went in the army, came back as a sergeant, and then came back in the lab.
No.
Then he and I were involved in bringing back the know-how for this special casting technique.
Right.
And we set up a small department
mm-hmm.
In that corner of the works.
Mm-hmm.
And incidentally also set up a small department along with Ray Barrett that made gas fire radiance. We got into
right.
making gas fire radiance.
Yes.
You remember the old box type of gas
yes.
fire?
Yeah,
the...
I do, yeah. Mm. Yeah, I think that's the era and the connection with which Ray Barrett's name has come up before.
Yes.
So that's come from another source as well.
Ultimately, that department, that work, part of the works got so big
mm-hmm.
that it moved away from there, spent a short time at Homer Hill, and then ultimately we built him a brand new works on the edge of Cricket Field Works,
right.
which is below Briley Hill.
Cricket Field Works, is that the one down Moore Street?
It is, yes.
Right, okay.
Down Moore Street.
Well, that was the J.T. Price.
That was the J.T. Price had the Cricket Field Works,
right.
which was a firebrick works.
Yeah.
And when J.T. Price joined with EJ&J Pearson, it was decided that they would build a brand new firebrick works,
mm-hmm.
which they built across the road, on the opposite side of the road, to the Cricket Field Works.
Right. So
and,
down Moore Street, I suppose that the thing that's sort of still there... Was
immediately
the
beyond the steel terminal.
Same side of the road?
On the same side of the road.
So Cricket Field Works was on the other side of
on
the road?
On the other side.
Where all those houses are now?
Yes.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
Okay, that sorts
that. We built this new firebrick works down there and the head office of EJ&J Pearson then.
And then ultimately, some of the people who were in the office at...
Yes,
probably just
they
after,
did.
After your
yes,
your time.
Yes, because
there.
It was the time when Harrison Pearson were running down.
Well, I
this had been a very large works, but in fact, the products that they made were becoming technically outmoded in the industry.
Right.
They did a vast amount of firebrick work for the gas industry,
they
the coke industry,
they did
a lot
of gas retort stuff. I think that was winding down,
yes.
wasn't it, a bit? And they
well,
did...
the retorts, yes.
Yeah.
What they made latterly were not the retorts,
yeah.
But all the ancillary things that went around gasworks. You see, as the coke or the gas was made
mm-hmm.
in retorts, which are cylindrical things, but they... waste gas and the waste heat was recycled
yeah.
and it all passed through a mass of chambers with firebrick packings in
right.
them, and it was the packings and the outer construction
I'm with you
of coke ovens and okay. gas works
yeah.
that were made with the sort of firebricks that they made
right mm. I understand, I see that
vast quantities
yeah.
and they were shipped all over the world because coke ovens were built and gasworks were built around the world.
They also did a lot of their other sort of staple clients, as far as I understand it. In addition to work with the gas industry, was the steel industry as
yes.
well, and particularly furnace linings, and also British Rail. as well.
Yes. The steelworks, they were not, the fire bricks were not used actually in contact with the steel because the temperatures were too high for the fire bricks by then.
Right.
But all the regenerators and recuperators that recycle the heat and help to intensify the temperature were all made of fire bricks.
So that's what they
sometimes did. They were simple rectangular shapes. Sometimes they were patented devices which were diabolo shaped and they packed together in certain ways.
What was the stuff they did for British Rail? Was it loco?
Loco arches, yes.
Loco arches, yes.
Yeah. And in railway boilers, initially, they were just simply built of fire bricks and arches. But because the life of them was so low, the steam was raised almost instantaneously.
Yeah.
And it really punished the refractories.
Yeah.
So the railways were in the habit of changing the boiler linings, the firebox linings, pretty frequently.
Right.
And to build these with a mass of small fire bricks was just too much. So we made shapes which fitted together tongue and groove wise.
Oh, right, okay.
That could be slipped in. And we
so, like
made
two or three pieces did the job of tens of bricks, basically.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
And each railway company had their own designs of these things.
Yes.
And we made vast
a bewildering number of them, I should imagine, with the
absolutely
different types of locomotive classes there were.
Yeah.
So presumably at the same time as we're talking about, I'm getting a picture now of the 1960s as it progresses. You're getting the steel industries building new works like Llanwern and various other things that are modern, that are operating at higher temperatures than Harrison Pearson products can stand. You've got the glass industry again, similarly, they're getting more precise at the kind of things they want. They're not looking for the traditional pot, they're looking for something a little more specialist. And you've got, obviously, the move away from the use of steam locomotives on the railways towards diesels and things. So they've got really threats and challenges in three of their principal markets, haven't they? And
people, of course, we were getting to the stage where town gas was not made from coal.
It went through the
conversion of oil into town gas.
Yes.
Putting them through catalytic converters.
That's their fourth market. So effectively they were being attacked on all four sides
of what
they made, basically.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's very helpful because that clarifies a lot.
But they also were one of the main suppliers of refractory materials to all those thousands of small industries, heat-using industries around the Black Country.
Right. And did they hang on to that sort of market a bit better than?
I suppose so, because indeed a lot of those are still going on now.
They are, indeed.
But, you know, the enamel industries disappeared and so on. Making things out of plastic now instead of bashing out sheets
That's
of steel.
Right. Let me put something else to you. The one thing that comes through consistently, particularly with people who worked in the offices at Harrison Pearson, is the fact that it was, in many respects, the phrases that come up most commonly are Victorian and old-fashioned. Now, did that extend to the sort of style of management that may have led them to hang on to hoping the market would pick up for what they made rather than aggressively
seeking?
No, I think
they were fully aware that the market was disappearing.
Right.
Yes. You might say it was Victorian in that some of the systems of making fire bricks remained or more.
Yes.
But it was just that the industry was changing.
Right.
Small furnaces for reheating metal instead of being made of a series of standard size fire bricks were beginning to be made from what we call plastic refractories, which were mixtures of crushed fire brick and clay, or crushed fire brick and high alumina cement, a refractory cement.
Yeah.
And they could be cast into shape, and there were no need for bricklayers to build these small furnaces. And every heat-using industry had masses of these small furnaces, and Harrison Pearson catered for those.
Right. Let's just go back to the actual office side of Harrison Pearson. Your dealings were mainly with Dr. Waterton and his successors. Did you see any other people who were in the main offices at all?
Oh, yes. Chiefly the works manager, Charlie Salt.
Charlie Salt, yes.
And he, when Dyson took us over, they were keen to keep changing the managers around, because that was the system in industry. Don't let the manager get too deeply entrenched in one place. Move him on.
Yes.
And so we had another fire brick manufacturer called Joe Dudley, who had for a period of time managed a fire brick works along the canal side, along the Salt Wells road there. And so by that time I'd become production director, and I was squeezed into the position of having to switch some of the managers around.
Yes.
So Charlie Salt was moved to another works for a period of time, virtually demoted, I suppose.
Right.
And Joe Dudley came along because he had certain expertise in running the huge Belgian kiln that the Harrison Pearson works centred round.
Right.
They had lots of small...
Lots of small round kilns.
Round kilns, but they had one huge Belgian kiln, which had to be filled and emptied in sequence, and it never went out.
Right.
And it was a very hungry animal.
Can you remember that I've had various numbers put forward for the number of chambers that that Belgian kiln had?
I think it was a 28 kiln there.
Okay.
But...
Well, that makes it 3-1 in favour of 28, then. That's pretty conclusive, then, I think.
They really moved on from chamber to chamber about 20 to 24 hours. And,
right,
you know, from chamber to chamber, and it took roughly a week or more to
Do you have any memories of anybody else in the office? I'll run through a few now. Do you remember Ron Pearson?
Ron Pearson, Ron Pearson... he came with Harrison Pearson into
the group.
EG&J Pearson group.
Yeah.
His family had run it for a long time.
Because he was a descendant of the founder, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Ronnie Pearson wasn't of the EG&J Pearson family.
No.
If he was, then it was... several generations ago.
I think there's some connection between the family when the two firms were started, but I think it had long...
Might well have been.
Long split off, I think. Yeah.
Yes, when the two firms started, I think there were four members of the family, all Pearsons, that had the Delph Works, which was the biggest of EJ Pearsons. And then... ultimately, Colonel Thomas, who'd come back out of the First World War, he came and got into EJ&J Pearson by marriage.
Right.
He married one of the Pearson girls.
Pearson daughters.
And then he was not being connected with the refractories trade at all. Before he married into it as something, and he found himself getting into partnership with Guy Evers. And so there was Colonel Thomas and Guy Evers were the two partners who ran EJ&J Pearson, and between the wars, as sometimes the fortunes of the refractories industry faded, other companies joined them.
Right.
And
so the Evers connection is how Elliot Evers gets to be involved.
Yes. Right. He's the son of Guy Evers.
Right.
Yes. And Guy Evers began his working career working for his uncles, mm-hmm. who ran Homer Hill Works.
Right.
The Samuel Evers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Guy Evers joined them mm-hmm. as a young fellow from school. I think he mm-hmm. was educated at Haileybury, I think. Mm-hmm. And he came there. And then he left his uncles mm-hmm. and joined Colonel Thomas mm-hmm. to run the Delft Works.
Right.
And then they acquired other works, the mm-hmm. Crown Works. And Harrison Pearson's came into them, and there were several others. Mm-hmm. There were works at Colleygate and so on.
Yeah.
And I think when I joined them, they had about 12 different works mm. operating, and at least 5 mines,
yeah.
work deep mines, mm-hmm. that is.
What?
I think... Mm. In some way, Trotter Haynes and Corbett's come into the Harrison Pearson.
They do. Well, certainly their office was in the same building.
Yeah.
And a number of the ladies I've interviewed who worked in the office said that there were 2 telephones, different numbers. And they knew, depending on which one rang, they either said Harrison Pearson or Trotter Haynes and Corbett.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Trotter Haynes and Corbett as a works mm. didn't exist. I think it was probably one of the works that was down in the valley below the canal
right.
in the village of where Withymore
is now. Yeah.
I think it was one of the works down there, mm. like Harrison Pearson's original
yeah.
works was
yeah.
down at the bottom.
That's right, yeah.
By the Plant's Hollow Pit. Mm. That works, when I arrived, that works down in the valley there was derelict.
Mm-hmm.
There were several derelict firebrick works down mm-hmm. there, and Trotter Haynes and Corbett may well have been one of them.
Right, okay.
There was only mines down in the valley.
Yeah, I mean...
The bottom of the valley.
A number of us have been a bit confused about exactly what Trotter Haynes and Corbett did.
No, it didn't do anything different from Harrison
no.
Pearson.
No. Was it just an acquisition of theirs then? Was it
was an acquisition... And I think they probably acquired it, possibly with the Plant's Hollow Pit.
Oh, right, OK. But, I mean, to continue trading, at least nominally, with the name, or they wanted to trade on its goodwill.
That's exactly that. They
yeah.
traded on its goodwill.
Yes.
Its name.
Yes, exactly.
The name was valuable to them. The Trotter Haynes and Corbett's was well known, and old customers still...
Can you recall
factories
what
from
they,
Trotter Haynes?
What they did as that was distinctive for his.
They were just in the general firebrick industry.
So in
yeah.
other words, that group of customers that Trotter Haynes and Corbett had got by acquiring it and by nominally trading under their name, they kept them with them. So it was a way of keeping customers and
yes
and broadening
yeah.
their
as
broadening
you
their
say,
customer base.
They had invoices and so on and
yes,
letterheads.
They did. Yes, that's right.
All that went out
yes, yes.
under that name and.
Hmm.
To an extent, most of the invoicing and the like was done latterly from Ian J. and J. Pearson's Delft
right.
Works office.
Yes.
But Ronnie Pearson, he sat up in his office and he he knew a lot of the Harrison Pearson customers and the Trotter Haynes Corbett mm. customers, and he'd visit them from time to time.
Right.
But he spent most of his time just in the office there.
Another name that's come up is Leslie Tonks. Do you remember Leslie Tonks?
Yes, Leslie Tonks. He was a clerk in the office.
Yes.
I think Leslie was chiefly concerned with wages and...
Mm.
That sort of thing.
Right, okay.
He may have been involved in sending out quotations.
I've heard him in connection with that, certainly, yes.
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 Quite often, you see, E.J. and J. Pearson would send business their way because it was all exchanged, you know.
Yes.
They'd get inquiries into E.J. and J. Pearson's office.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Harrison Pearson would get the same inquiry.
Right.
And this went on throughout the Stourbridge firebrick industry. There was the Stourbridge firebrick association.
Yes.
Where most of the fire brick manufacturers, not all of them, but most of them, mm-hmm. subscribed to this. Mm-hmm. And there was a system before the Monopolies Commission got hold of it, whereby they would ring into the office of the Fire Brick Association, which was in Church Street, Stourbridge.
Right.
They'd ring in daily with all their inquiries, and they, of course, exchanged prices to make sure they were not competing with each
yes.
other. And then it was the luck of the draw who finally got the order.
Oh, right. So it was almost like a central brokerage, really, for the...
Almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And okay. there's an element of that certainly went on between E.J. and J. Pearson and Harrison Pearson and the other fabric workers.
Because ultimately, if they traded it around between the companies in the group, they still got the business, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
But Harrison Pearson was famous for, I dug this out, this is an illustration.
Right.
This is Samuel Evers' thing, but Harrison Pearson were famous for virtually keeping a stock of all this multitude of shapes mm-hmm. and sizes mm-hmm. that were all derivatives of a 9 by 4.5 by 3 brick.
Right.
So that a 9-inch brick could be had in any thickness from 3-inch
right.
Down to 0.5-inch. And then there was the 9 by 6-inch mm-hmm. and so on. And then there were also...
So by piecing these together, you could line a furnace of any size, shape,
absolutely.
Or form. Right,
yeah.
And that's basically what they were for.
Yeah.
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 So you've got, I mean, in front of me there, you've got
you see, all
slivers
these,
and slightly wedge-shaped pieces.
Yes,
yes,
this one, you see, they had a system whereby for telegraphic communication, they all had a code name. Extraordinary.
It is amazing, isn't
yeah.
it? Absolutely astonishing.
Yeah. Yeah, but they were famous for that.
Yes.
In that of all the firebrick works that we had, Harrison Pearson kept the largest stock mm-hmm. of these standard shapes.
Right.
And, of course, there were circle bricks and arch mm. bricks and so on. Whereas the other firebrick works in the group tended to have specialties. The Delft works specialised in... domestic refractories. Mm-hmm. They were huge manufacturers of great backs.
Oh, right.
And liners yeah. for all-night burning stoves.
Yeah, those sort of three pieces you used to have to buy and put in the back
that's
of your
right.
brain.
Yeah. 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 They yeah. made those in vast quantities.
Right.
Either to customers' patterns, the
yeah.
fireplace manufacturers had mm. their names stamped in the back of them.
Right.
And they were made either in one piece, mm. stamped out in huge presses,
yeah.
or they were made in 3 and even 4-piece sets where there were side cheeks and 2 back cheeks.
So what you're basically saying is that the other fibric manufacturers, apart from Harrison Pearson, were either into heavily into a niche market, as we call it these days, or into more bespoke sort of work.
Yes.
Whereas Harrison Pearson were slightly more general.
Absolutely.
And these stockpiles of bricks that you've showed me the pictures of, they would manufacture those and stockpile them in the hope that people would want them rather
that's
than
right.
making them to order.
That was one of the things of Harrison Pearson. By and large, the other manufacturers were making to order.
Right.
Exception. The domestic firebricks were yeah. made vast quantities.
Because there was a steady demand for them.
There was a steady demand
yes,
for them.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, another thing that's coming to mind now is you know, thinking about why Harrison Pearson aren't still with us and the reasons for the decline of the company. When you're getting into more recent times, you're starting to get the sort of accountants driving things, and that company must have been a nightmare in terms of the type of amount of...
Yes, so it was, mm. but it was one of their strengths too, because they had a system whereby mm-hmm. they put into stock at low value, and then when trade picked up,
ah.
they pulled it out at high value.
Right, okay. Okay, yeah,
and that was well known.
No, that's an interesting. Yeah. It's an interesting alternative view.
It's
of
an
that.
Interesting
yeah.
thing because
yes.
we were taken over when I was at Gibbons. We were taken over by Steatley.
Oh yes,
huge
Steatley
manufacturer,
yes, they are,
of a special kind of refractories for steel industry.
Yeah,
and Steatley was owned by a number of steel manufacturers in Sheffield. The directors were all steel manufacturers, really. And when Steatley took over Gibbons, they tried to change our finances on our red brick side overnight. They couldn't understand why we should put red bricks, building bricks, into stock, because they'd never done that. They'd always been very keen to keep the stock levels at the very lowest level. And they came to us and told us to cut our stocks down, and then trade picked up and we got nothing to sell. You know,
isn't it always the way?
It was a difference in philosophy completely.
Yeah.
And to an extent, Harrison Pearson lived on the fact that they always had bricks in stock when the demand was there.
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent. I think that's as much as we need to talk about at the moment. I think that's really, it's been really interesting. It's given me lots of insights and confirmed a lot of suspicions that I had about things and the way things actually worked.
Well, the decline of
cast
Harrison
a bit of light
Pearson
onto things,
really ran in parallel to the decline of pretty well all the rest
of the
fabric
industry. There's nothing exceptional,
industry.
Really, at all.
No. But it was chiefly a complete change in the way of manufacturing steel.
Yeah.
In manufacturing iron, blast furnaces, there has been a complete change in the sort of refractories that were used to line the blast furnaces and the heat recovery devices.
Yeah. Is this because of higher operating temperatures?
Higher operating temperatures. Yeah. They were pushing them harder and harder.
Yeah. Okay.
So that instead of blast furnaces being lined with fire clay blocks, they were lined with blocks pressed from minerals which were brought from South Africa and the Negev Desert and all this sort of minerals.
I suppose and a lot of these fibric works in the Stourbridge area were only where they were because they were surrounded by the clay they were using. And once you start to bring the... There's no actual need for the works to be in one particular area.
No, not only that. Invariably, the new bricks had to be fired at much higher temperatures
than
a much greater precision, so that instead of having a plastic shape, which shrank perhaps 10% in manufacture and wasn't very precise in dimensions...
Yeah.
People were demanding things that were precise within a few millimetres, so that the bricks were then being made by huge presses, hydraulic presses of 3,000 tons.
Yeah.
You know, they were dry pressed without moisture at all, and with very little clay in them. They were pressed with non-plastic minerals with a minimum, perhaps only 1 or 2% of clay to bind them together, so they could be handled into the kiln, nothing more.
Right.
And with artificial bonds, such as things like what we call sulphite lye, which is a waste product from paper manufacture. It's a kind of sugar syrup thing that was used as the bond.
So is the counterside of what you're saying about why so many of the traditional... the reason why Dysons have survived is because Dysons are one of the companies that adapted and took all these new things on.
Dysons were in a position that Dysons originally were firebrick manufacturers in exactly the same way as EJ&J Pearson. They made domestic refractories as well as a wide range of ordinary firebricks. But about 1905 or so, the guy who owned Dysons had been quietly buying shares of a company called Pickford Holland, who were established in Sheffield, and they manufactured high-temperature bricks for steel melting using chrome ore, magnesite. They also manufactured silica bricks from pure silica, quartzite rock, none of which Dyson's had any use for. And so Dyson's gradually acquired that kind of work.